Hey folks, welcome back to the Live Everything Podcast. This is your host, Trevious Caldwell. Hey, I really appreciate you hitting that button, spending your time with me today. I hope you enjoy what you hear. And if you do, and if you like it, subscribe to it and share it. And let me know if you need any elaboration on what I'm talking about. I spend a lot of time trying to share my experiences with you and other folks who I otherwise wouldn't come in contact with. So I hope this helps you become a better you. It certainly helps me become a better me. And I hope you enjoy what you hear. Thanks. Hey folks, welcome back to the Live Everything Podcast. This is your host, Trevious Caldwell. Today I am co-hosting with two colleagues from Duke University, and we're going to be talking about beyond the boundary of the ivory tower. So we're going to try to unpack this idea of the ivory tower. We're going to talk about civilian and military culture, and then we're going to just discuss some unwritten rules of academia. So hang tight, and I hope you enjoy. Hey folks, welcome back. I'm so excited today to have two colleagues with me today to talk about what I consider the ivory tower of academia and all things civil military. And before we introduce them, you know, I just want to lay down a purpose for this. One, it was really twofold. One, to give a particular perspective to folks from the military transitioning into academia and kind of lay down some perspective there. And I'll show my experiences with that. And then the second perspective is for folks in academia, my colleagues and other folks who really experience a grad school experience in the classroom where there's unwritten rules or apprehensions that go unspoken. And so hopefully we'll talk about that today. And I am excited to welcome Amber Manning and Professor Taylor Black from the Duke University Department of English to the Live Everything Podcast. So welcome. Welcome.
How are you doing?
Doing well. Doing well. You got to pull the mic a little closer so you can. Yeah, this is cool. I appreciate you guys coming down doing this for me because I know it was an impromptu. I think you said you were like, yeah. You should have us on. And yeah, here you are.
Here we are.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to ask you guys both to introduce yourself briefly, but then talk a little bit about, I guess, the theme of this podcast is Beyond Boundaries. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to really explore the benefit of crossing boundaries, whether they be geographic or cognitive, musical, as I've talked about before in some of my podcasts. But your own experience with crossing boundaries with respect to the ivory tower, mm-hmm. if that means anything to you, I'd be interested to hear what that is. Taylor, you want to go first?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I was born in Durham, North Carolina, and moved away. I moved away from the state when I was 18. Went to undergrad and grad school, and came back for this job in the English department. And I was very familiar with Duke, but from the perspective of someone whose family works not for the university as an academic, but on the other side of Duke, my Aunt Jean worked in the hospital. She ran the gift shops. She was the president of the Pink Smock or the Women's Auxiliary. Mm-hmm. And so she ran the gift shops and the snack bars and everything else. And so my whole family kind of worked for my Aunt Jean at one point or another, and including myself. And so I can recall coming in the summertime and hanging out with my grandmother, who I liked a lot, who worked for her daughter in the stockroom of the gift shop for the hospital on at Duke. And I remember taking breaks, coming over, walking around campus is sort of like – it's also abstract to me now, but sort of just wandering around, like looking at these weird students who are here. But coming here to the Bryan Center actually to meet my father, who used to come get his haircut downstairs here in the basement level. There used to be this Dr. Fowler – not Mr. Fowler – had a barber shop that was open until like I think the first year I got here in like 17, and then they closed. But
wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, now I'm in the basement level talking to you about transcending boundaries.
Maybe this was the barbershop area.
I can't recall exactly. But yeah, I mean, you know, I've come all the way around to the other side. I'm the only person in my family who's done this, you know, PhD thing or is engaged in this side of the university.
Yeah.
It's just funny, you know.
Does that stick with you that you're like the knowledge bearer, if you will, of the family? I don't know.
I don't think about myself as a knowledge bearer. Maybe on my good days, which don't happen that much. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's you know, I don't take it lightly. It means a lot to my family and to me. And Duke is certainly a much fancier institution than I've ever been a part of as a student or as a worker. You know, my undergrad was at a Hunter College in New York, which is kind of a commuter school, great school, part of the city university system. And I went to grad school at Rutgers Newark, another commuter school. This is fancy.
I'm going to ask you a little bit later because I know you studied Black Studies at the undergrad. At Hunter, yeah. And I'm curious to know what prompted you into that area. You can elaborate on it now or we can wait.
I mean, the same reason I did American Studies for my PhD, I was interested in American history, American culture.
Yeah.
And I started taking Black Studies courses as a part of doing that, as well as like U.S. history courses and sociology courses. I think at that time I didn't have a sense of literature as being a way to do this. Mm. I knew that the historians seemed kind of boring to me, and I'm still kind of feel that way. And sociologists and anthropologists seemed to be fooling themselves, being just too scientific. It just seemed like, you know. And I think the Black Studies courses, you know, they seemed to be giving me an American history that. And so one class led to another. And then, you know, finally I was a major.
Yeah. Yeah. That's compelling. I have some comments on that, but I'll save them.
Why? I mean, no.
Well, because I want to get to Amber.
No, go ahead. You should comment now.
No, I guess.
I've noticed from listening to your podcast, you like to put pins in things.
I do. That's my thing. So,
but, you know, I'll elaborate. Also there's something to be said for just, you know, seeing something to the end.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting because from what I experienced, thinking about Black Studies or American history, there's an overlap in the sociology, in the history, in the literature that's almost unavoidable, if you will, for that overlap. Historians are more focused on facts. But then that, you know, that's subjective from a particular perspective, right?
And the subjective was a huge – the sense of history being someone else's project, is history being a kind of product of a kind of white supremacy.
That's right.
Yeah. That was very clear in this department. This was one of the first Black Studies programs in the country. It's historic. You know, John Henry Clark, I think, was someone at Hunter who started the program. Mm-hmm. It's now called the Africana, Puerto Rican, and Latino Studies Department, or it was when I got my degree.
Black Studies for me has sort of evolved because I think being Black, I'm going to make a generalization here. There is this like constant identity quest that continually happens. And so, you know, whether it's sociological, whether it's historical or through the literature, there's always sort of this reckoning back to a sense of belonging that never really comes. Mm. Like it's always like trying to answer the question that you never really get the answer to. Yeah. You can just experience it. And in hindsight, that's the process is sort of the answer.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I'm. Mm-hmm. That's what I've been feeling in and out of the military and academia. Right. But yeah, so great.
Awesome. And if it's not clear to listeners, although I'm sure it is, I'm white. I'm a whitey.
So. He's got a camel jacket on the back of his chair. It's great.
I guess that
it's vintage. No, it doesn't.
It is vintage.
It is vintage. Yeah. It's great. Yeah, awesome. Amber,
I don't know what to talk about now. I guess. Duke, I enjoyed listening to Taylor talk about him being here as a kid because I've never ever been at a private institution. Mm. Neither of my parents graduated from college, but you know they both like are much smarter than I am and probably better read than I am. Mm. But it's interesting to think about little Taylor here because now my children like come to Duke all the time just are like in this experience
them,
and meeting these people, which is just when I think about when I was their age, just such a radical difference in the kind of life I had.
So. Yeah. And those are the stories that they're going to tell in the future. You know, yeah. I used to teach at West Point, and I would bring my kids to the classroom while I taught. And I hope that, you know, they saw that and it'll stick with them because they have no conception that daddy's in the Army. Like, in their mind, the Army is school.
Wow.
Which is crazy. Yeah. And so when your kids get older, I wonder what their memory is going to be with respect to Duke, or if they would see it like I saw it as unattainable, unapproachable. It was just so, like, this gets us into the ivory tower thing. It was so, like, kind of out there as this facade, and I only saw it on TV as this you know, this very affluent place. But for them, that's not the case. It's like, I bring my kids here, and they don't – not that they don't like it. My son said, this passes the look test.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think my kids have an awareness of that, too. Even just, like, they've commented before on, like – the difference even between sort of like seeing me at work and me at home. Like, I don't think that I'm really different, and they've both said that. But I think that part of what's helpful is that they see like what a mess I am all the time. And so like to see that translate into someplace like Duke, I think makes it hopefully a little bit less.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's great.
Aesthetically fancy.
Yeah. The atmosphere feels inviting to bring kids, you know, to the job. I don't know. From my perspective. Yeah. Because I don't know. I like bringing my kids here.
I do too.
We've gone. Not that you don't. We've gone to the little dining place. Now I've not brought them to class or anything like that. If I did, they would try to jump in on the conversation. My son definitely would.
Right.
And that might be. Well, you know what? I did bring them to class once. We have class at a cafe, which is another great luxury.
Which cafe?
The German one.
Google Hof.
Yeah, I will butcher it.
Yeah.
But I brought three kids there, and they sat at another table, and we spent 3 hours having seminar, and they just drank Shirley Temples.
You just, like, picked up another kid?
Yeah, well, I had to go up to West Virginia to pick up my daughter's friend, which that's the Mount Airy thing you heard when I was on the road to West Virginia, and I passed through Mount Airy, which is the fictional town of Mayberry.
That's like Gomer Pyle.
Yeah. I stopped at a gas station and everything. I did the whole tour, and it was underwhelming. And then on the way out, I passed all these Confederate flags and folks out there selling antiques.
Yeah.
I was going to stop and buy one.
I grew up in the shadow of Pilot Mountain.
Really?
You know, Winston-Salem.
Yeah.
Just, you know, down the hill from there.
Yeah, that's interesting. That place was – I didn't know what to expect, but yeah, to get that to your point, yeah, they came to the class and –
That's cool.
Yeah. I didn't see a lot of people like you in Mayberry.
None.
That show, so none. Maybe you did know what to expect.
Yeah, well, there's two episodes, two guys.
There are two black men.
Yeah, so. And two other episodes – you got to look way back in the crowd. They're just there.
I see.
You know, as spectators.
What's the crowd doing?
I think they're. I don't know. I think the power went out or something. Yeah. No, it's not what you think. I still watch Andy Griffith sometimes. I get a beer and I sit on the couch and watch it.
On
TV.
Well, I understand. Syndication. Oh, you're watching like live television.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I just get a beer and I don't know if it's some nostalgia. It's weird. Yeah.
Nostalgia for a time you weren't a part of.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. I think I like the life lessons that Andy was giving his son. Mm-hmm. And then you grow older, you know, this guy's patriarchal, you know, Aunt B.
Yeah.
Is at the house making supper, which I never had supper before. Anyway, that's another story. But like, I guess I like that part of it. The idea of being outside, like the going fishing and not having to think about stuff, just father son relationship.
Did you watch that when you were younger?
Yeah.
I mean, it could be nostalgia for that too. Like, I'll watch stuff like Little House on the Prairie, which like obviously I'm not nostalgic to be a pioneer, but I like think about when I watched that when I was younger.
I used to watch shows when I stay home sick.
Yeah.
And that's what was on TV. Yeah. So.
And The Price is Right.
The Price is Right.
Yeah. Listeners to this podcast will understand you have an affinity for strong father figure types.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. It's weird, right? Those are all the sitcoms. And you commented on one of the podcasts. And
well, I think in your first episode, you were listing your TV fathers, you know.
Yeah.
Family Matters.
Carl Winslow, Uncle Phil.
Fathers with big beer belly fathers. I was waiting for you to list Colonel Taylor from A Different World. But
yeah. Because I think I came upon that show later.
I see.
And yeah, that wasn't a part of my like adolescent.
His stomach wasn't big enough.
Yeah, his stomach wasn't big enough.
Wait,
yeah.
So those are all your TV fathers?
Yeah.
Who are your TV daddies? That's better.
TV daddies?
Yeah.
I don't know.
like not just like the
Uncle Phil was pivotal to me.
Yeah.
Because that's the one episode where Will's dad comes back and like that thing happens. And so I had something like that happen with me. And so Uncle Phil, I had an uncle that really kind of took care of me. And so I saw Uncle Phil as that guy. And plus the show was just great. So I really enjoyed that one. And then Family Matters. And then in the episode I did, I kind of juxtaposed all of those shows with the other sitcoms I used to watch. I used to watch Dawson's Creek. I used to like go to McDonald's, get an apple pie, and sit and watch Dawson's Creek at Tuskegee.
Were you a Dawson or Pacey fan?
I was a Pacey fan. Yeah, because he was like a rebel.
See, they filmed that show when I was in high school. It was filmed in Wilmington, North Carolina. And I can recall.
Really?
Yeah, like kids from my school would go be extras on the show.
Really?
Yeah.
It was so like, the only thing I couldn't get over was like these kids' vocabulary was like so ridiculous. And they're supposed to be in high school and they look, I don't know. It,
it
was
like 25. I've never watched
it. Yeah.
Because they probably were 25.
It was weird. Yeah. It was weird. I'm doing another podcast later on about my experience. I spent a summer on Martha's Vineyard and Dawson's Creek kept coming back to me because of landscape.
And, well, you're here. You're 2 hours away from Dawson's Creek.
Well, yeah, I'm not going there.
You're not
going
to. Well, Wilmington is not Mount Airy. There's, there are black people there.
I know. It, it will still destroy my experience of what New England is. Because in my mind, when
is
I watch.
Is that where it's set?
No, that's where it's set.
Oh, but they just.
Yeah, it's not
it
supposed to be in
North
Carolina.
Yeah, right. It's set in, I think, Martha's Vineyard, Cape Cod area.
Oh, I see. But
yeah. You haven't seen Dawson's Creek?
No.
I think you would like it.
After all this time, probably not going to watch it.
Yeah.
I don't know. You made it this far.
Yeah. So back to the Ivory Tower.
Yeah.
this is a great caveat, though. I guess I'll share my experience at the Ivory Tower, and I don't know. I love to hear yours. But yeah, I grew up in the public school system, and I went to HBCU. So the Ivory Tower, if you will, was always related to predominantly white institutions, but not any not like land grant institutions like Auburn. You know, it was like the Harvard, the Yale, Duke was definitely a part of that.
Yeah.
And it was closely tied to like economic status where, you know, you not only had you had to be smart to get in, you had to be a certain status to get in. And I think I still think about it in that way. But then the flip side of that, too, not from an undergrad or graduate student perspective, but from an academic perspective, I've always had some ambivalence with academics only because I feel like there's a certain dissonance from reality and theory that exists. And so this Ivory Tower sort of mentality suggests that you've lost touch with reality and reality to some academics, I know I'm generalizing, is the theory of it all, right? So it sounds great in the room, but it's not applicable in the streets, if you will. So, and so I try to grapple with that and my place in it because I sometimes feel like a hypocrite, right? Because we're armed with this knowledge and the this vocabulary and this grammar, and it's like, well, not everybody has the time to talk about these things or the vocabulary to go deep on some of these theories. So now I'm thinking, okay, what is my responsibility as a I don't know what did I call you a carrier of the knowledge? do I have a responsibility to dispense that knowledge out to, especially to soldiers, you know, in the military, if you will? Like, what does that mean? That's how I think about it, and I go back and forth sometimes.
I think you do.
Yeah,
you dispense. You mean by dispense? You mean translate?
Yeah, translate it. Yeah, in a way that's useful, you know, so that folks can understand what they're seeing, and then where that puts me in the whole scheme of things, because sometimes I look out. And I just see zombies walking around, mindlessly walking around, not even knowing what's happening around them. And then I feel guilty for that because it's like, so I don't know. That's sort of my.
We're all interested in the human condition.
Yeah.
You know, we just, you know, people in these professions or people in say, literary studies are just choosing to focus in on it a very particular and as you're saying, kind of peculiar to the outside way. But. It's no different than, say, like a theologian or a psychologist or a social worker. I mean, or a soldier. We're all just, you know, we're trying to figure out while we're here what it means to be a human being and how that has meant what it has meant to be a human being for other human beings.
Yeah. What's the end?
The end of what?
What's the pragmatic aspect of that, though?
Well.
I think I know. But
I mean, I think that that consciousness, also I think that capacity for cognitive dissonance or for ambivalence or whatever. It's what we get as human beings. I mean, perhaps other animals think like that, think about their existence as such. But I don't know. But I think that's our burden and our privilege as human beings is that we conceive of ourselves as human beings.
Yeah.
And that causes for us a kind of crisis or a inspiration or whatever. It makes our life mean something.
Yeah. And I wonder if part of that is like thinking about what a pragmatic end, first of all, whether we need to have that.
Yeah.
And secondly, like what something looks like pragmatically. Because like when I taught high school English, did I think that the texts that some of my students read were gonna be like deployed in their life in a particular and structured way? No. But do I think that like some of the texts we read affected them to the point where they would make different choices or navigate situations differently? Then yes. So I think part of what I think about like doing this work is that we have to, I think, as humanists sometimes, or actually as people, I think we have to come to a different understanding of what a pragmatic approach and a pragmatic effect looks like.
Yeah.
Because not everything is going to affect structural change, but I don't think structural change is going to be affected unless people are different.
Yeah.
Right? Like people have to be willing to hear stories. People have to be willing to listen to narratives in order to really, I think, change anything. And I think part of what the ivory tower at its worst does really well is make people who are not within it think that they can't hear those stories and they can't access those narratives. Yeah. Like everyone can understand Foucault.
Yes.
Everyone can understand all of the things that we're talking about, but the academy really benefits from pretending like that's not true.
Right.
And then being like, well, this isn't pragmatic knowledge, so like people who are doing different jobs don't need it.
Right.
And I just don't think that's true. Like we all need to understand Zora Neale Hurston.
Yeah.
Right. Like we all need to do that, whether or not we're teaching her or doing something different, just like we all need to like understand probably how to fix a car.
Right.
You know, I mean, to me, those are it's the same thing. Like you were saying, like about what we're doing here and what it means.
Yeah. An academe, like any other closed off society or elite institution like the army, has its own set of values that are within itself. And more than just like what Amber's saying, sort of not inviting others in or not thinking of yourself in relation to the outside world, what else – another thing that can sort of contribute to a kind of myopia on the inside is people forgetting that the values of the institution are that they're not the values of the whole world. So, you know, people who stop thinking of themselves – as themselves and start to think of themselves in terms of their career, and then they become kind of walking careers.
Yeah.
And their values are only reflected – they only reflect their relationship to the institution, what they think the institution values in them. That's something else. I imagine this is tracked in the army too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's really where the rot happens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I did a podcast about this multiple identity complex, especially in the military, because we have a uniform. We have like a mask, an external mask. Mm-hmm. When you put this uniform on with the badges and ribbons, and your agency is wrapped up in all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And you kind of there's some alienation that occurs.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Which I really want to not talk about here, but I want to do a podcast on that and Lacan and all that kind of stuff. But you're right. That happens. But to your point, Amber, about, you know, the academy really – I would say they profit off this idea that, you know, this is not for everyone. You have to have access to it, whether it's economic or some type of lineage. Yeah. That's or problematic.
Or be exceptionally gifted.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and this is – so I'm not going to, like, do all kinds of union talk on here. But part of the – I'm serious.
Do it.
But part of the thing that's frustrating – about like the graduate students trying to have a union that's recognized by Duke is that Duke insists that we are not laborers but have the potential to be exceptional scholars. Mm. And that kind of language and that kind of distinction, I think, is more than just like Duke talking to its own graduate students, but I think like really a distinction that the ivory tower has falsely created and like wants to continue to maintain.
Yeah, yeah. You know? And for the listeners who don't know, like it costs $70,000 a year to go to Duke.
Right,
which is ridiculous. Now, you can walk around and see the great dining, which you still have to pay for that. And maybe the studio time is a part of that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, gosh, you're paying for that amount of knowledge when you can go on Google and search a syllabus and read the same stuff. And I grappled with this for a couple of weeks. It was after I left your class, and no diss to the class. But I was thinking, I said all the stuff we're reading here today – we could probably go and Google and read ourselves, but what you don't have is a seminar.
Yeah.
You don't have, you're not a seminar and you don't have the time. So I'm like, man, then somebody's paying for time.
Right.
Right. To sit down and have these discussions. I think I stayed up that night thinking about this, about like what's being afforded and like how much does this cost and like what are we gaining from it and all that. And it's really, for me, it came down to the time to actually do it, yeah. you know, and not be consumed with everything else. And then that was problematic for me.
Yeah.
You know, and then enter Joe Winters and the economics of it all. I'm like, yeah. holy crap. So I've been trying to figure all of this stuff out, and maybe there is no solution to it. But I know at times here I feel like I'm in my element, but also completely out of place in a certain way.
Me too.
Yeah. There's like a hypocrisy of it that I feel like I need to go back and call somebody and tell them all the stuff that I'm learning. That's why I'm doing this this podcast, is to try to break even a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's interesting.
What's healthy? You said you have ambivalence about the institution. That's healthy. It means you haven't lost your sense of the outside world that you're worried about losing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I also come at it from a unique perspective too, which is sort of segue into the second conversation about this civil military thing, right? So me being on fellowship, I have to do in 3 years what you do in six. Granted, you have to teach, you have to TA, and I don't have to do those things, right?
Forget.
So,
and you have a teaching job waiting.
I have a teaching job waiting on me, right? So then I question. I'm like, okay, because I made this statement before, and I think folks here, there's two sides. Let me be careful how I say this. Maybe I shouldn't be careful how I say this. In my research effort, I have to be more proactive in what I am doing, because nobody's going to be proactive in helping me do what I do. I have to sort of take the lead on that, because everybody else is busy with their own stuff, and it's not because they don't want to. Mm-hmm. So I'll just be clear about that. But me doing this in 3 years, you know, I have to sit down and do the book list. I got to call the committee together. I got to make sure that they're on board with these decisions. Nobody's doing that for me, right? And then I don't have the time to really explore. I can do some exploratory learning, but in 3 years, I got to know what I'm talking about, because like, I will be out the door in 3 years doing army stuff.
Right.
So then I straddle the fence between the professionalism of academia and then going back to my profession, which is the army.
Yeah.
And there's some complexity there that doesn't sit well with me, because it feels like I can't pour into academics like I want to and become a part of a scholarly conversation and do focus on military at the same time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to do both.
Right.
And so it's almost like, you know, this guy's not a real academic. I've been in MLA and heard these discussions, not about me, but, you know, the gatekeeping that happens in academia.
Yeah.
You know.
I'm sure that's true.
Yeah. I don't know. What do you guys think about that? Because, and you can be brutal or not, because, you know, it's like, I won't say his name, but my predecessor that was here had the same type of situation.
Sure. Well, and I think, I guess my perspective on that is a little different, in that the further you get in the PhD, the terror of not knowing what happens after, I feel like, is very distracting. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, like, obviously what you have to do is so different, and I don't like, but at least like you sort of know where the money's coming from and what happens at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that is like a different space too. But I agree with you. And I think for me to take a military person seriously in the academy has been easy, because I started with your predecessor, right? Like I haven't been at Duke without him. And so to me, it just seemed natural. Like, I saw him in class.
Oh, interesting.
He was so smart, like a good scholar, like doing interesting things, like still had like different personality quirks, like the way he told time and stuff like that. But so I feel like I have never like kind of thought about that attitude. And I think that our department, in my estimation, liked him so much that I never really felt like. But I didn't see him outside of that context. Like, I didn't see him outside of, in an academic context, outside of a whole bunch of people who really liked him as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I realize that that completely affects it too. I also think it probably is different for you as a Black man. Right. I mean, in the unique intersection of the position that you're in and also your
identity.
And he came from, I mean, he'd had a master's at an Ivy.
My master's is from Auburn.
Right.
Yeah.
Clemson, Auburn. It's the same thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Pretty good to me, you know.
Both orange.
Yeah.
Yeah. My Auburn experience was interesting. But I'm grateful for the perspective, because I did go to HBCU, and then I ended up going to the land grant Auburn, and I taught at West Point, so that was a whole nother thing. And now I'm here at Duke. So it's like I hit every part of the spectrum in a certain instance. And it's interesting to reflect on the different cultures that exist in all of those spaces, because they're so unique.
Yeah.
And now I come here as an amalgamation of sort of all of them, and then you lump on the black thing, which I'm still trying to figure out. I say the black thing deliberately, people. That I'm still trying to figure out too, and it's very complex. And then I got to somehow, in 2 years, set all of that aside, and then go lead 800 soldiers.
Right. And that's what you'll do instead of teach, or before teaching?
Prior to teaching.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm trying to figure out how to take this scholarship and do something with it in the 2 year gap that I have, so that when I go teach, I can pick up where I left off. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking through that stuff now, but. I don't know. Maybe it's just to act it out, to like take everything I learned and be a physical manifestation of that intellect. And
maybe.
You know?
I think you're assuming, I think, that learning – the fact that you have to learn in a compressed manner is somehow like keeping you from learning in some other way that other people are learning. No one has ever really done. And there's never a moment, no matter how much time you have in seminars or with the books you're reading, to really – feel like you've gotten where you need to be. And that's at least for people who are oriented towards scholarship, that's what keeps you going. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
So you'll keep reading as you're teaching or as you're not teaching, and you'll keep learning from the things you read. And if you stop learning, then, you know, you've started to think of yourself as an expert instead of a human being, and, you know.
Yeah.
That's not good.
No, I think it's great. What I'm thinking about as you're talking is the line I have to skirt with some of this, some of the stuff that I've put out in the podcast, and the very apolitical nature that is the military, right? Yeah.
Because apolitical.
Military is very apolitical. We can talk about that too.
I mean,
yeah, I know. Yeah, okay. I will be happy to talk about that.
But go on, sorry.
But I say
it conceives of itself as apolitical.
Yes, I'll grant that.
Yes. Sure. But say, for example, the race critique that I talk about, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, here I know in 2 years I got to get in front of a bunch of people who don't look like me and lead them.
Right.
The moment they listen to this podcast, they're going to have preconceived notions about the way I think and the decisions that I make. Mm. I don't have to be careful about that, but there's a little voice in the back of my head that says I have to be mindful that people are listening to this and they will prejudge me based on this commentary. And I am doing it from an authentic place, saying, hey, here's who I am.
Right.
Right. Here's how I make decisions,
right.
And I like to think this is very vulnerable and authentic. I would rather you have that than me kind of hold this stuff in and you not know what's happening.
Yeah.
So it's a risk I take.
Yeah.
But those consequences are real, and you never really feel them because these are conversations that happen behind closed doors about you.
Sure.
And that happens too. So I'm very mindful that that all works out. And shout out to West Point, because I'm thankful that I've been accepted back there anyway. So if it all goes to shit, I just go teach for the rest of my career. But I do enjoy leading.
And
I do enjoy being out in the field.
I wonder if what you're talking about, I'm interested in, it feels like at least the story that we get in the media is that there is more like sort of personal agency and transparency now in the military.
Absolutely.
In terms of people being able to like tell their story and like be in People magazine and talk about the stuff that they did and all that kind of stuff. Do you find that still to be the case, or is that how heavily, I guess, first, do you find that to be the case? And secondly, how heavily regulated is the personal narrative that we get from how heavily regulated by the military is that? Maybe you can't.
It's better now. The Army is kind of going through a renovation, if you will. We've changed the uniform in a sense. The model
is literally, or
yeah, our dress uniform is different. It harkens back to like World War II era stuff. I'll show you a picture of it. It's good.
Very apolitical.
It looks great. I know. so that's happening. The slogan is going back to "Be All You Can Be."
What was it prior?
It was Army of One.
Oh.
And now it's Be All You Can Be again. And then the Army adopted a people first strategy to really be more inclusive.
Like people first language.
People first language, an effort toward acknowledging the person beneath the uniform, which I think is awesome.
Yeah.
Right.
That comes from like education pedagogy, like people first language, like saying like a student with whatever instead of the diagnosis.
Oh, okay. Well, no, so
that
not
a rich tradition.
Not particularly the language, but here's an example. If I'm a company commander and I want to have a discussion about race or gender, then I'm going to bring my soldiers in civilian clothes. I could do that. That way, cognitively, they're not looking at themselves as specialist, private, staff sergeant. You take away sort of the visible power structures in place, and now I can penetrate that to talk about the people. And maybe doing something like that would solicit more personal stories or testimonies or things. And that just builds trust because now you know one another.
But what is the point of building that trust?
What is the point of building the trust? If I tell a guy to go charge a hill to kill someone, he'll do it without asking why.
Right. I mean, and so this is like it's an interesting way of thinking about what the motive, what the goal is,
right? Yeah. At the end of the day, you still have a mission, right?
Yeah.
But at least I want to make sure that the folks I go in there with, you know, if I have to go to battle, that I know who they are and I know what motivates them.
Yeah.
As opposed to them having a preconceived notion of me because they listen to a podcast and so I ask them to do something, they're not going to do it.
Yeah.
Right? Because I'm singling them out.
Right.
So the people first strategy has worked. Here are the risks associated with that, though, right?
What if you don't like the people?
Well, it's not about liking them because we got a job to do, right? That you revert back to the rank.
Yeah.
It makes it easy. But I think once you cross that line, you get to be that vulnerable with your soldiers. There's a boundary you got to understand exists that some of them can take advantage of, or you can take advantage of it. And here's where you get into fraternization and things like that, right?
Right.
And so you gotta be mindful of that. And I don't know that most soldiers or leaders are equipped to do that. I know
to draw the boundary just because the military has always made the boundary for you.
Yeah, that's right. Hmm. So you're gonna exercise some risk trying to do that.
Right.
Right. It helps me transitioning out of the military into this type of space because I'm surrounded by I ride that bus with all these undergrads and these are the same type of soldiers that are in your ranks. So the same conversations, the TikTok and Instagram, all of that stuff that they're having, they're doing now. They're doing it in the military too. It's the same people, except for the fact that in the Army, we're all cultivated by a value system that's very, I don't want to call it rigid, but it's pretty rigid. You violate this value system, and then you're going to be under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is its own adjudication process. Mm-hmm. It's like a separate world. And that has been complicated to go in and out of, coming in academia, out of that space. But Taylor, we had a conversation, I think, a semester ago about transitioning those worlds. I think, well, not even, it was a couple of weeks ago. I told you I came from that class where I got into the debate in the class about, we're talking about the military industrial complex and the prison industrial complex. And a student made a comment about, we're going to be careful here, about domestic violence that happens at a micro level. That happens with a military
like
service member.
Oh.
Yeah.
I mean, everywhere domestic violence happens.
Well, yeah, but it was almost a statement that this is prevalent in the Army. And you know, alcoholism is a deal in the Army. And you know, that happens, but not all the time. It's a generalization. And so my point was that I think we got to understand that, you know, folks who work in prisons, for example, and people in the military or academia live in my mind, two separate worlds, right, where I can go deploy to Iraq and Afghanistan and my mind frame and how I view affinity is different than when I come home and I take the uniform off and I'm a civilian. This gets into that civil mil gap, if you will. And it's got to be an appreciation for that transition.
Yeah, or the difficulty of that.
The difficulty of it, yeah.
I mean, is it statistically – I don't know. Is it statistically accurate that people in the military are more likely to engage in domestic violence?
I don't know. I don't think so.
That smells like.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, it might be an isolated situation, but like the, you know, a holistic story of the military is never told. It's very sensationalized. I remember explaining to somebody because they asked me about going to combat. And I'm sure my predecessor would say the same thing. Like you spend 30 days in complete boredom and then 5 minutes of the most exciting thing will happen to you. Like you get attacked, you get shot at, somebody gets blown up for 5 minutes. And then you go through another 30 days of just boredom. But all you ever see on the TV is, you know, those 5 minutes on a loop. And so people think that that's what it is. But, you know, if you're doing counterinsurgency, you never see the help that you're doing, if you can call it that, because it's overdetermined by war.
The help that you're doing. What do you mean?
Well, so when we're doing counterinsurgency, you
soft
know.
Soft power.
Soft power. We had a strategy called money as a weapon system, right? Which is really interesting. Yeah. So what one of the stories, and I'll be brief with this because I don't want to monopolize y'all's time talking. You know, I would get about, I don't know, probably about $200,000 in cash. That's probably what it was. I'm 26 years old. Okay. Have no clue about economics, if you will. But I understand like leadership and I got a lot of good people around me, and the Department of State was working with us. And so we take this 200K and we go out into the area of operations that we're working, and we'll talk to local villagers and we'll say, okay, you have a farm, right? But you need concrete perhaps, or what do you need to help your farm flourish? And they'll tell us, well, here's some paperwork for a micro grant. Fill out this paperwork. But in filling it out, you have to buy your concrete from this gentleman who happens to have a concrete factory two blocks down the road. And then we go to that gentleman and say, hey, what do you need for your shop? Well, you know, if I take on more business, I'm going to need another building because and I'm going to need laborers. And I need to pay them. I don't have the Well, here's some micro grant paperwork. Fill that out. We will fund that for you if you hire these folks. And so you create this economic monopoly, right, where the money is circulating within the village itself and no longer dependent on the U.S. to influx, right, to bring in. So that you create this type of interest in sustaining their own economy and securing the space so that Al-Qaeda in Iraq don't come in and try to disrupt it, right? And we did that in the first 2 months, and we didn't get attacked once. And we can cut down our patrols now, and we're not visible in the streets anymore because they have a vested interest in their own economy that we jump-started. Now, that could all go to shit when we leave, but for the 12 months that we're there, that's something good, I think, to celebrate. But that story never gets told, you know? That story never gets told. So anyway, as a caveat. That's a caveat.
I mean, I think maybe that story doesn't get – I think that, like – The narrative of them, I'm trying to say this in a way that is not. I think that there are different places where different stories of the military are told.
Sure.
Does that make sense? Yep. Like, I suspect that there are places where stories like that are told. I think that in maybe more like in academic institutions, those are probably not the stories that are told.
No.
Does that make sense? You see what I'm saying? Like, makes sense. Bet that there are places that stories like that become more important than the other kinds of stories that we might hear more here.
Yeah. Well, I was in Runge's class. I'll just say it was a great class, Post-Colonial Foundations. And I asked a question. Nobody could answer this question, and I don't blame them. Cause
I bet Taylor can answer it.
Well, it was interesting. It was, the question was, I'm writing this paper for this conference in about 2 weeks, and I'm arguing the premise that Black service members suffer from a legacy of slavery and segregation in this country. And because of that legacy occupying the minds of Black service members, when we deploy to other lands and occupy those spaces, there's a tendency to have an increased level of empathy for the local nationals there, especially if they're subjugated as well. And if that happens, then there's an opportunity to intervene in any type of imperialistic motive, neo-colonial motive. Any of that stuff can be intervened upon at a micro level. Now, will it affect the whole? Probably not. And Runge's comeback to that was very relevant. She said, well, it's still overdetermined by war because you're still in a situation of war, which is true. So I'm grappling with that.
Wait, when you say intervene, do you mean that the Black soldiers are less likely to kind of like – be using
unnecessary force.
Oh, unnecessary
force. Unnecessary force. So if I go to a house and I have to kill or capture a guy and I don't have to kick the door in to do it, I'm not going to kick the door. Because by doing that, anybody in that house, especially if they're children, they're going to harbor that memory with them. And then 10 years later, we'd be fighting a collection of those kids. You see what I'm saying?
But if you're the owner of that house, your house is still being invaded, whether or not it's done in a polite way.
That's true.
Like whether the door's kicked down or not.
I think that's the comment about
they're still taking everything.
I think so. Depends on what the gentleman did. Yeah. You know, I interviewed a week ago my old interpreter from Iraq, and we did a raid like this. He told the story, and the guy was he was like a bomb maker. He went up to Baghdad and he blew up soldiers and he came back down and he slept in our village. And so we did this raid on him, and Iraq was undergoing the status of forces agreement at the time. So he had to go through the judicial process, but they couldn't do anything to him. They couldn't prosecute him. So we had to go pick him back up and take him back home. Right. And in the process of doing that, he saw my interpreter's face, who lived in Baghdad. And so once we left, he started to threaten my interpreter with death notes and all of these things. And some of that, I don't want to say it could have been prevented, but how you enter the space, I think, matters, especially if I'm putting the guy back on the street.
You couldn't get that interpreter a visa?
He got a visa. He lives in Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, good.
Yep.
Good.
Good. Yeah.
That's why he called you victories. Jesus.
What happened like to the Jesus. Other guy? Yeah. What happened to the other guy?
The guy we captured?
Yeah.
He's back, probably back at home right now in the same spot, you know?
Just hanging out.
Yeah. But I don't know what you do with all of that stuff. And, you know, and soldiers come back with all these memories, you know.
I've got jobs to do. You got a lot going on. It's intense.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Like trying to make sense of
that's
that.
It's overdetermined, too.
It is overdetermined.
Yeah.
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 Yep. But you can imagine, you know, me sitting in these classes, I'm like, you know, sometimes it don't work out that way. This is great insight because I always draw back to some of these memories.
Yeah.
And it's just, it can get a little complicated for me because I bite my tongue sometimes.
Well, to be, I said this about you in the fall, to be in a literature course, reading a book about war, we did, a Toni Morrison book called Home.
Yeah.
With someone who's killed people, certainly a very different experience than being in a room full of students, you know, who haven't killed anybody.
Yeah.
You know, you have a whole, you know, your consciousness is out on a whole nother, you know, another horizon, you know, and so it's not abstract to you.
That's right. It's not. But I also know that folks don't understand those situations either.
Of course.
So, like, and how could they?
And would you want them to?
No. Right.
That's what I'm saying. Your consciousness is, you know, it moves in a different direction.
Yeah. Yeah, perhaps. It's still frightening for me.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm happy to have those conversations, but I do get to a point where it's like, they're not going to get it, you know. And I don't know if that's selfish of me not to try. You know what I'm saying?
That's the civilian-military divide then.
Yeah.
Right. They're not supposed to get it.
Right. I mean, don't you want them to not get it?
Yeah, sure.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, absolutely. The military probably needs us to not get it.
Yeah.
In some ways.
In some ways. But there needs to be some type of felt, shared, like, affinity. Because if not, if there's a population who just doesn't know, for example, that we're at war, and, like, I make a comment about this. You know, I came back from my first deployment, and, like, everybody around me was talking about Housewives of Atlanta. Like,
it's a very good show. And to be fair, there is some serious drama on there. And, you know, depending on who you ask, you know, like when, you know, Sheree tried to shift Kim Zolciak's wig. Depending on who you ask,
like
these
early,
matters may
that's
be
an early season.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen every season, but I'm just going. I'm going to some of the iconic moments. I mean, international affairs, Kim Zolciak's wig being shifted a little bit by Sheree. I don't know what's more important.
Yeah, what's more important?
We'll leave it up to the audience.
I tell you what, I was
depends on who you ask. You
know. I was fucking furious when I came back, and that's
why it's such a good show.
I know, not because of the show, but like
it's the best of all the Housewives. Atlanta has fallen off a little bit. They've lost their way. They need some of their main characters back, like Faith Park.
I think Salt Lake is pretty good.
I won't watch Salt
Lake. The Housewives.
Someone's going to jail.
Yeah, but they're not. You can't even. They could be from anywhere. I mean, they should be more. The show should be more Mormon.
That's part of the show.
A little bit, not enough for me. It just didn't have enough of a. I have a lot. This is a different podcast. Yeah. I have a lot to say about this, but it just didn't have. It didn't have a sense of the region.
Can you imagine like? And now I'm not that sensitive about it now, but can you imagine a person who just came from like Baghdad doing into a conversation?
But I think part of this is. I imagine part of this is because we don't see war any longer. And I'm sure the Army prefers it that way, right?
Absolutely.
So during Vietnam, you know, as the story goes, we could see the violence. We could see the bodies, you know, on both sides. We saw and then, you know, since then war has become abstract. It's like you see the invasion of Iraq was seen as a kind of like green and black video game. And the media doesn't show soldiers coming home in body bags. The media doesn't show, you know, civilians that have been killed by American soldiers or American soldiers being killed by others. We don't see that. And so support for war can become a kind of patriotic, sentimental experience. And it is abstracted, again, from the reality that you understand. So, of course, people are more worried about
the
act. They're actually seeing the drama on the streets of Atlanta between, you know, Sheree and or when Nene, you know, choked Kim Zolciak on during while she was on tour with her Don't Be Tardy for the Party song. You know,
so I got to understand that later on. Like, and it didn't take a long time.
This is not Sweetie.
Well, yeah, right. that's the way it probably should be. Not probably. That's the way it should
what
be.
Should be?
The dissidents that exist.
I think if the nation's going to be at war, and we don't declare war anymore either.
Right.
There are just conflicts that never end.
Right.
And conflicts which apparently have a capitalist arm to them. You know, we're also now. You know, we're giving microloans to people, and then we're also like setting up an investment economic relationship.
Right.
But you know, the idea of a war and an enemy that's clear—it's changed, right?
Sure.
Which is why, I mean, that makes sense to me why the army would go back to World War II uniform.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
They should go back to declaring war.
Well, it's almost like a spirit, like
that's what I'm
trying to recultivate—a spirit of patriotism.
Because this is like those. It was so easy to have literally a bad guy. Mm-hmm. In that, you know, during the Second World War, mm-hmm. and to sort of craft everything else as the tentacle of the bad guy, and I think that's harder to do now.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
If not impossible to do.
Well, I'm hoping that we don't start to construct one for the sake of, you know,
things have changed.
I know.
You know.
Yeah.
We have a lot of problems here.
The problem is that now we have made so many bad guys, like we can't. You know, like,
yeah, it's kind of ubiquitous.
Can't forget about Russia.
And we can't pretend that we're number one anymore either.
Yeah. Well, that's a different conversation.
Are we number one?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm not going
to
comment.
It's not so great to be number one, you know?
No.
It's lonely. Yeah.
Everybody's coming for you when you're number one.
Yeah.
What China
doing? I think the Army writ large, at least from my last unit, was more invested in partnerships across the different alliances, like the ASEAN or Indo-Pacific. Because we're out in the Indo-Pacific region all the time with, you know, the Philippines and Thailand soldiers and everything like that. So it's more partnerships to say, for example, you know, prevent China from invading Taiwan, for example, right?
So then we train other people to fight for the United States.
No.
Oh, okay.
Not colonialism.
Oh, okay. Right.
No.
It's not colonialism.
It's not colonialism.
We're helping them to help themselves.
Not colonialism. Yes.
To advance our global political interests.
There's some coded language happening right,
right
now.
Okay.
So I want to switch gears a little bit. I don't know what we're done with the civil military relationships.
I think we're done.
Yeah. Are we done with it? Yeah. We're getting to politics now.
Apolitical.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, I got solicited by the University of Louisville to do a lecture. They're going to pay me too. It's great. On politics, some political aspect.
Cool.
Not cool.
Because I got about it.
Yeah. So what I'm going to do is Schiller. Okay. I'm going to do Schiller and aesthetic education being sort of a foundational aspect of political freedom.
Wait, you can't talk about politics.
I have to be careful about politics.
He's not going to critique the army.
Well, yeah, but you could be political without critiquing the army. Because the army is political, so you can't talk about
it. I have ambivalence again with politics, too, given my situation and my
– It's nonsense, too.
It's nonsense?
What are politics, whatever that
is. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I'll very briefly describe my ambivalence. I think – like I don't know what I'm seeing anymore, right? So these terms, right, left, Republican, Democrat,
right,
liberal, mm-hmm, progressive, conservative, mm-hmm, all of these carry with it so much baggage,
right, mm-hmm,
that when you sift through all of that, mm-hmm, what are we talking about now?
Neoliberalism.
Perhaps. But even that is still loaded. Neoliberalism. So I have not done the knowledge work yet to peel all of that back, mm-hmm, to figure out what it is I'm advocating for. And until I sit down and do that, then I can tell you where I fall down politically.
It sounds like the beginning of a presidential campaign.
Does it? No, that's not what it is. That's not what it is. But this is where my ambivalence lies. Because the moment I label myself into a camp, I know what happens socially. Ostracism happens.
In the army.
Exactly. Yeah. My ability to lead will be affected by it. And I don't do it for that reason, but I really want to know what I'm talking about. So if you say, oh, Trevius is a Democrat, okay, well, let's peel that back. What does that mean? And these are questions I ask myself, right, and I don't know that I can answer them right now. So I don't engage.
Makes sense. I mean, you all have to do your jobs from one administration to the other. And
yeah, you know, despite you have, the commander in chief is the commander in chief.
We don't want you.
Look at Eisenhower.
Yeah. Well,
you know, we don't want you losing sight of that.
Yeah. At the end of the day, my confidence, I have confidence in the chain of command. And if the commander in chief is President Trump, for example, dispense the order, by the time it gets down to me, it's been filtered
so much
that I, you know, I can take the order and carry it out. And I'm and I'm happy that no one tells me how to execute the order.
Right. And now we know we should be grateful for those.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So, so that's that. Let's talk about the classroom real quick.
Okay.
All right. Unspoken or unwritten rules in the classroom. Here's one I'll just throw out there.
We're talking about the graduate classroom or the undergraduate
classroom.
Or just
classrooms in general.
So I guess we can talk about both. Should we do them separate?
You tell us.
I don't know. Let's start with grad.
You've been in graduate classrooms this year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So start. What, so unspoken or unwritten rules?
Some of our listeners may have never been in an undergraduate seminar or a graduate classroom.
Sure.
So they don't know what we're talking about.
Okay. So we're talking set about a 2.5 to 3 hour conversation that's prompted by a set of readings.
Sure.
And discussion questions, whether that's facilitated by the instructor or peer students.
Right.
Or sometimes just a lecture.
Or it could be just a lecture.
Sometimes it's just a lecture.
Which I tend to like the lecture. Toro Moore and Sarah Beckwith does a really good job. They did a team teach seminar.
Yeah.
Really good job. And they talked for like
the whole time,
3/4 of the time. But it was great because it was all new knowledge for everyone in the room. Now, at Duke, here's what I found to be distinguishable from any other school that I've been to. And it's not good or bad. It just is. There's more of a global perspective in the classroom because you know, folks are from everywhere around the world, and you got different languages in the classroom as well. And so, and sometimes the instructors go into that.
Yeah.
Versus a West Point is somewhat homogenous. Auburn, very homogenous, and Tuskegee, homogenous as well with respect to race and ethnicity. Right.
Yeah.
So there's a difference here. Here's the one thing I keep going back to: unwritten rule. And I'm unapologetic when I say this: I am not reading everything on the syllabus. I can't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I cannot read everything on the
syllabus. Nobody's reading. And well, that's not true.
Some people try.
Some people are.
Yeah. And you don't have
to.
I'm not going to say you don't have to. But I guess for me, the one thing that I benefited from coming out of my master's program, getting a little bit older coming here, is I found the thing that I was interested in, and that's what I'm focused on.
Well, you know yourself. So as you're reading, you know that the reading is engaging with your sense of yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Once you've kind of. You feel like you've gone through the readings for the week and you feel like, all right, I know what I'm going to say about this.
Right.
I know I could spend 3 more hours closely reading this, but I'm probably going to end up saying X.
Yes.
You know.
That's it. It's like, okay, what am I going to get on stage with? Be brief, be brilliant, and be gone.
Yeah. Unless you're in a grad class with like one other person.
Which happened to me.
That happened to me too.
Right? It's like two people. There is no hiding.
But this was a writing workshop you were in too.
No.
What class was it?
This was with Professor McGinnis.
Oh.
Black Mobility. It was great.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
it
right.
It was you and who?
It was me. I won't say the other names.
Just you. Just two. It was like you and one other person.
It was 4 people in the class. One was tapping.
Oh, okay. See, okay. I was in the class with literally one other person.
Yeah.
I mean, it was your class.
Right.
It was great.
We just basically had a book club.
After, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I thought that was like.
Yeah. But for that, I felt obligated to read everything. For 2 reasons. One, there's no hiding. Okay.
Yeah.
There's no hiding.
Right.
But then 2, the content was really interesting and I didn't want to miss nothing.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But man, that was labor intensive work to do all of that. And so I made a decision, even coming in here, that I was not going to do that for every class.
Right.
Yeah.
Because nobody does.
I just can't. You know, it's not that I'm interested, I just can't.
Yeah.
But I also see people who struggle.
And that's why you like the classes where you lecture, because you let them tell you what it's about.
That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I read enough to have an understanding of what I'm seeing.
And then you read it after the lecture.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
and it's actually better probably.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess from an instructor, because you teach undergrads here.
Yeah.
Yes. And then you teach both undergrad and grad. Can you tell them that? Or you can't. You don't want to tell them.
Tell them what?
Yeah.
That they shouldn't read everything?
Yeah.
I just tell my students to be strategic. And I'm like, but, you know, if you're not doing enough to be able to have a conversation – then you're not going to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
But like, there's no way. I mean, I have no idea what kind of shit they have going on from week to week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, even the best student, I think sometimes will just have a week where they can't do it.
Yeah.
You know, and to like hold them to the expectation that they're going to do. Honestly, I feel like if I assign 3 readings, I'd rather have the students do 2 of them and like actually really think about it and be able to talk about it than like glance at all 3, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It amazes me how many students don't think they have that option.
Right.
Right. Like, even when I was teaching at West Point, like, and that we're not even giving a lot of reading when right. I was there, but like, they come in and say, oh, I couldn't read it because I couldn't get to it. Well, you could have read like three pages and right. just come in with that.
Right.
You know? I don't know.
At the same time, though, I'm not someone – I don't assign a whole lot
no.
of reading, and in part because I sort of – I feel like I'm trying to get students interested in what I'm mm-hmm. giving them.
Mm-hmm.
And I do the readings, too, because I'm trying to recall my own interest in it or reshape my own interest in it. And, you know, I try not to lose sight or have them lose sight of the fact that the stuff we're reading is not – it's not – like we're calling it the readings or the text or whatever. They don't just exist to torture us
right.
and to give us
right.
– to take our time. It's you know, it's a blessing that they exist. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
I mean, you know, reading a novel, it's crazy what goes into writing a novel.
Yeah.
I mean, just like a sentence, you know, a metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can't keep this in mind all the time, but I do try to recall and have that sense of kind of wonder about, you know,
yeah.
a song, a novel – even an academic essay, like someone was able to conceive of this and they had to,
yeah.
and they had to live and experience the whole world, you know, long enough into just the right moment that they could conceive of something in this way. They could create something out of nothing.
Right.
You know, we can't forget that.
Yeah.
You know? And we also can't over inundate students with texts so that it just becomes this chore.
Right.
And we lose sight of the beauty of the whole
right.
thing.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think students can tell the difference between an instructor who's like assigning them things that they're like, really excited about and like
right.
like are going to take joy in talking
yeah.
to their students about, as opposed to instructors who are just like, you need to read this
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
You know
exactly.
what I mean? Like,
yeah.
and I think that
yeah.
like you do a really nice job. Taylor does a good job of that in his undergrad class. Like he is very excited about what he's talking about. And
yeah.
it's a kind of like invitation for participation for the
yeah.
student. And that I think makes them want to read it more.
You know,
does
the,
that make sense?
The students
yeah.
who don't, yeah, you can't fake being interested in something.
Right.
And, the students who do well in my classes are the students who develop their own interest in the thing that we're talking
yep.
about.
How often do you both take in consideration the personality of the student and exploit that for the benefit of the class?
Exploit? What do you mean?
So if I know a student is gregarious and will speak up.
Oh, yeah. yeah.
And everybody's like
oh, yeah.
silent, you just call on them.
Well, okay, those kind of students want that.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I would
it's
I would
not always
say,
a good thing either.
No,
yeah.
I mean – the problem, yeah, I guess I do that. I think everybody, well, then maybe that's not true. I definitely do that. And then sometimes it backfires
yep.
because then they think you're always going to call on them.
Mm.
Yep.
And then it's
yep.
like,
yeah,
hell chat fest from
yeah.
whatever. You know?
Or and they think they know the text better than anyone else.
Yeah.
And then they stop actually engaging with it. So actually what they say just becomes repetitive, especially
right.
to the other students.
And I mean, the other students are starting to like, figure out new things.
Yeah.
yeah. I mean, sometimes the worst kind of student is the one who comes in telling you they already love the thing that you're teaching.
Yeah.
It can be great, too, if they actually mean it. But what they often mean is they've already come to a conclusion about it.
Yeah.
And
mm.
it's part of how they think of themselves. I love X.
Right.
And
do you dismiss it?
I don't dismiss it, but I'm aware of the fact that it sometimes means that they're done thinking about it.
Yeah.
And they're the most resistant to sometimes experiencing the text. You know, I sometimes wish with those students I could just, you know, defamiliarize them or, you know, make them smoke marijuana or something before they come into class so at least they can experience the text differently, you know, because
yeah.
they're so sure of it, you
right.
know.
Yeah.
I try not to seem too sure of the text. There's still something mysterious about it or else I wouldn't be talking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so that begs the question then. You know, a second reading of any text considers your growth as a person too.
Sure.
Because you're looking at it from a different perspective.
Sure.
And I know my teaching style I get very vulnerable with my students. This is long ago at West Point. I will probably do the same thing. But there are also idiosyncrasies that I could do, things I can do at West Point that I can't do in a Duke classroom.
Yeah.
Like what?
I mean, I feel like at a private institution, you could probably do more.
No. Yeah.
I don't know.
Let's hear what he
yeah.
has. What are the things you're doing?
So I always go back
making
to this.
Making push-ups?
No. Or I've done that before in class. Or, you know, I can't say this.
Why?
Well, because really I wasn't supposed to do that at West Point. Second lesson of class.
You waterboard them?
No. I write. No. No.
Abu Ghraib?
No. Oh, my gosh.
Just hopefully, a little photo
hopefully
shoot.
Hopefully I still have listeners at an hour and 3 minutes.
Stand on that box.
On the second day of class.
But you get a micro grant after.
Yeah. Second day of class in my literature class, I write the word nigger on the chalkboard. Mm. Second day of class. Now, West Point, they're not going to take out a phone. They're not going to take a picture. They're not going to get up. They're not going to walk out because they're afraid of my rank.
A black teacher could do that at any university.
Okay, let's talk about that.
There are teachers who do that here who probably shouldn't.
Dick Gregory wrote a whole book.
He did. Yeah, but he's a scapegoat in a classroom.
Is he?
Oh, yeah. I use the text as scapegoats. I taught Randall Kennedy's book, mm-hmm. right, the same name. But Randall Kennedy's not in the room. I can talk about him all day long.
Gregory said he wrote the book, so anytime someone said the name, you know, they could be quoting his book instead of, you know.
That's sly on Dick Gregory's part. You know, but you say any black instructor could do that. I believe there's some validity in that. But then that's kind of like problematic too. Because I had colleagues at West Point, when I tell them I did this, they said, oh, I can never do that. I said, yeah, you can. I said, you could do it. Absolutely. I said that the words that come out of your mouth after you do it is what's going to get you in trouble.
Right.
Not the act itself.
Well, I guess in that sense, anybody
can
do it.
Are you talking about not white colleagues?
Yes. Absolutely. I mean,
anybody can do it. They just have to deal with the consequences of it. Yeah.
Well, they got to deal with the consequences. And then at a place like West Point, there's no rhetorical velocity. You only have word of mouth now. Right. But at a place like this, people would take pictures. It'd end up on Twitter. The news feed would get it, especially in the CRT
time.
But
thank God.
Well, it depends on how productive – because that conversation – at least
right. But I would make the argument that, like, you doing that was productive because you did it.
Yeah.
Like, there are probably lots of people at West Point, just like any other institution at Duke, who would do that in a way that it would not be productive and maybe, like, offensive, borderline violent.
Sure. Okay. I buy that.
Right?
Yeah,
so I think that's like the difference. I see what you're saying. And I think I understand the side of like protocol and the protection that that leaves to the classroom space is like a different kind of sacred space of learning. And I think that's really good. But I also think part of it is that you are just like not shitty at teaching.
I can recall, I don't know if you remember this, you sort of having someone explain to you.
I remember exactly what you're talking
public,
about.
In public, why people would be sensitive about that. And you handled it. You know, you kept your cards close. You handled it affably.
He texted me that night.
Well,
yeah,
he was explaining to you why people, are sensitive to language, as if anyone needs that explanation.
Well, but here's the problem with that. So
but
we're
it was
reading
interesting. It was interesting
people.
To watch your. Fred it was Jim interesting Jim. To watch you, and you were being graceful and affable. It was interesting to watch you, but also I could understand that you were absorbing that. You know, you were just like nodding, you know.
Yeah, I understood what was happening. You know, we were reading the Flannery O'Connor short story, and the N-word was used sporadically throughout.
Oh, you told me about this.
Yeah, but now we didn't address any of it for a particular reason. But the same lecture
– We had. I mean, this is a course where we were reading
– that particular day. Mm-hmm. And I was, I was curious about that. Now, granted, I didn't bring it up either. Okay, so let me just throw my cards on the table. But in the same discussion, somebody made a point about – sorry for the graphic nature of this – about a kid's ear being stapled to a wall in speaking about the Holocaust. And that was palatable to a certain extent in the classroom. We were talking about it. But then the explanation I got from this former student about this word was that, well, we're trying to establish a safe space for folks. I'm like, we just got to talking about about this graphic image.
Yeah.
You know, so who are we protecting?
Right.
You know?
What story are you talking about?
Wait,
the lame shall enter first?
Someone's ear is stapled to the wall?
So. No, no.
In the Holocaust?
No. Somebody made it. There was an antidote.
Okay.
Wait, it wasn't in a story.
And for those who are listening and wondering what we're talking about, we're talking about a class that was where we read Flannery O'Connor and Toni Morrison. Flannery O'Connor's stories, which are, you know, categorized as like part of the Southern grotesque or Southern Gothic. And they tell the story in very, very accurate terms of the American South.
Yeah.
As an unbalanced and haunted place, haunted by itself. And so, the stories are they're not sentimental in any way. They're hard. They're hilarious in a kind of like medieval way. They're kind of grotesquely comic, and everyone is lost. Yes. Everything is unbalanced, especially. I mean, everything comes from racial imbalance, and the stories depict that. So this would have been one of many stories we've read which represent that imbalance.
Yeah, I just think that I guess this is iceberg of a larger issue for me. In a literary space, I feel like you should have the academic freedom to discuss these hard things in a productive way.
Yes.
But I think the productive way is what gets tricky, because I think that people have different ideas of what is productive.
Yeah. So
and that's where it could get scary.
Yeah, and this conversation that you were bearing witness to was not about the safe space in our classroom. It was about a pedagogical safe space that as people, graduate students who are all going to be teaching literature one day,
mm-hmm. yeah.
He was sort of giving you advice as a future teacher, or, you know, as if you hadn't taught.
Yeah. You know. Well, so I get that. And absolutely. And at the time, I didn't know that's where he was coming from.
Yeah.
But I get it now. I guess what I'm saying is that in a seminar room mm-hmm. with colleagues and the doors closed, we can have some real conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I think before that happens, so it would be great. I think I told Professor Moore this. So it would be great before the seminar starts. Let's just come to a collective agreement on what we're trying to do here.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, so that everybody understands that, you know, if we're going to try to formulate a grammar, because you have some students in class that have extensive knowledge of works that they've read and nobody else knows about.
Yeah, yeah.
So these words come out and nobody knows what the hell they're talking about.
Right.
That happens in graduate school.
And
all
it can
the
be
time.
Hard, and it's hard to – to ask someone.
And it only happens
it's
in
scary.
Graduates.
Yes.
Yeah. But like, you know, if we got to cultivate this language so we have shared understanding, let's do that on day one so we know what we're doing.
See, the high school teachers know what they're doing sometimes.
Yeah, I think so.
This is the kind of stuff you start like a middle school English class with. Mm. And that's not even, I'm not, I like,
yeah, no.
I mean that, you know,
in
I think that
way.
We've unlearned
yeah.
the sort of ways of like establishing a classroom lexicon or grammar.
Yeah,
that we've sort of unruled. Like even in elementary, my kids like will go in on the first day and they like make the class rules together and like how we're going to talk about our classmates. Are we calling them friends? Are we calling them, you know what I mean? And I think that
that's good.
Obviously, it's different. I don't mean to like say that grad school is the same, but I do think in some ways it would be beneficial.
It would be like, you know, one of the trends that I've seen here and granted, I've only been in it for a year doing this coursework. But, you know, you sit beside these students for a semester. You don't know any of them.
Yeah.
Like you know, you just get up and walk out the class when the seminar is over, and you got all of this knowledge in the room, and nobody knows what one another does.
So,
you know,
when you go to graduate school, I'm explaining this for listeners, at least
that.
In English or in some sort of humanities, I went for American studies. You spend your first 2 years taking courses, and then after that, you have 2 or 3 years sometimes, and then after that, you have a sort of intense year or extended period where you decide what your fields are, what, you know, I'm going to study American literature from the 19th century. I'm going to focus on race. I'm going to focus on war, whatever. You go into a year where you sort of hibernate and you read as much as possible. And then after that, you declare yourself open to questions about these different things that you say that you've read deeply in. But in those first 2 years of coursework, there's something that happens, which is that more often than not, people start playing expert, or people start sort of leading with their expertise.
Yes.
And this is, I mean, this happens, I'm sure, in all kinds of different communities or institutions or fields of employment, which is like, again, like I said earlier, there's a moment in which you start to just see the world through the values of the institution you find yourself in. And one of those is, for academics, expertise. So people start communicating not just to say something to their colleague in a seminar about the text that they're reading, but also to communicate that they know something else,
right. mm.
that they've read X or they've consumed Y.
Right.
And, you know, this kind of happens throughout the career, but as I recall it as a graduate student, I think it happens in a really extreme way, pretending to be an expert – or not pretending. Talking to prove one's – intellectual worth, as opposed to talking to communicate.
Yes,
and to think about being intellectual as a kind of form of participation or communication with other people, as opposed to something that you demonstrate to them about yourself. And so people they don't say, "What are you talking about? I've never heard that word before. I don't know who Lacan is. I don't know who Deleuze is. I don't know who Foucault is." They don't say that because they start to think, well, if I say that, people will think I'm the really dummy.
Right.
Right. And this never ends. And so academics, while they're cultivating a sense of themselves as an expert and as the smartest person on X subject, they're also carrying along with them the baggage of this inferiority complex
mm-hmm.
that everybody has.
Right.
Because the first time someone mentioned a theorist that they'd never heard of and everyone else nods and they think, well, I can't tell other people I never heard of them. And then they think, I'll get to reading them later. And then they never do. And so their whole career, they've got, you know, that
the ghost.
They're just where you have to fake it. It's sort of like not knowing someone's name, but you don't admit you don't know their name. But
then it gets too late.
You see them, you know them 2 or 3 years. You see them every day, and you can't ask after 2 or 3 years.
Right,
that happens.
Yes.
So that starts in the grad classroom, and we all have memories of that. There are people who do it to greater degrees than others. You know, showing off, but they're not communicating. They're just showing off, and in showing off. They're sort of contributing to this inferiority complex, the academic inferiority complex that is
prevalent.
It's huge. It is so huge
everywhere
because people don't say "huh," and so that's I tried. I mean, we all do this. I'm not saying I'm totally absolved of this, or that I don't have any of these problems myself, or we don't. That people don't ego trip, and that I can ego trip myself, or that maybe it's okay to ego trip, I mean, Nikki Giovanni wrote a great poem about it, or called that. But I think it's important to know when you're ego tripping, and also important to remind yourself of the person who wants to say "huh." And so I think I think it's something that grad seminars should encourage more.
Yeah, I know when that happens, I shut down. Like
we all do.
I just
and the person talking is shut down too, because they're if they knew what they were talking about, they wouldn't have to say it in a way that other people didn't understand.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They could translate. Like you said earlier, I want to translate to military people the stuff we're talking about here in the ivory tower. That translation is an act of humility, but also an act of a higher intellectual consciousness, being able to say something in terms that someone who's not inside your head can understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want people to be excited and not impressed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I feel like you go through the first third of the seminar just trying to tease out everything you just said.
All the personalities.
All that. And then the middle third, the meat of it is really where the learning happens. And then you're looking at the finish line.
And there's always people who do it more and there's people who do it less.
Yeah.
And as teachers, we should, we should do more to help people, like just say, let's just drop the baggage when we're here. Let's all, let's all humble ourselves before these texts, which are mysterious and beautiful and or complicated and horrible or whatever it is. But like, let's as a group of people, let's find a way of communicating.
I think that's productive. At least if that's the only takeaway pedagogically that I get, which I think there are more, but that's really important to just sort of do that up front, I think. Well, cool. Well, let's segue. What I do typically to end these things is I'm going to put you on the spot. I'm sorry.
Wait, can Taylor plug his book first?
Well, this is great. This is a book discussion. Absolutely. So what I was going to say is, and you should definitely plug your book, I leave the reader with 3 books.
Oh, yeah.
So this is great. Look at that. That's timing.
You lead the reader?
With 3 book recommendations.
Oh, okay.
And I have one, and I'm going to ask you to maybe throw one out and plug your book, please. But I'll start, if that's okay. I just got through reading a book from the Black Marxism class by a gentleman named DeVarian Baldwin. And the topic is In the Shadow of the Ivory Tower, How the Universities Are Plundering. But the premise of the book is how universities become universities, right? This idea that the economy around the university sustains the university itself to perpetuate what you talked about, Amber, this idea that the cultural capital, the academia is like – exclusive to a particular body of folks.
Yeah.
And then how that happens with the infrastructure around the place and gentrification and all of that. It's a very, very good book. It's DeVarian Baldwin's In the Shadow of the Ivory Tower, How the Universities Are Plundering Our Cities. That's the name of it.
Okay.
That's my book recommendation.
Taylor, you should go next while I think of one.
I mean, I think for this audience, I mean, I mentioned the Toni Morrison book Home that we read. Which is her second to last book, and it's a short book. It's like 120 pages. It's short, but it is not small in any way. It's the kind of book that you can read if you're taking a flight from the West Coast to the East Coast, you can finish it on the plane and never be done and not be done with it. It's a great book, and I think soldiers would understand more than anybody this book, which begins with this guy Frank Money coming home from the Korean War and trying to get back home. He's sort of making a reverse great migration back down to his hometown, Lotus, Georgia, and recalling and remembering everything about his life. And it's a good book.
Awesome.
Okay, I'm going to recommend something way different then. The book that I last finished is called Legends and Lattes. Mm. It is a Dungeons and Dragons fanfic that I borrowed from Maggie, who borrowed it from Hannah. Okay, but honestly, the reason it's cool is it was just like a really nice, pleasant read and like really queer in like a cool way. And it might be a good balance to the books that the two of you recommend for people.
Awesome. Well, thank you. So we're going to close up here. We went long today, but I think it was worth it because we had a good conversation. So I really appreciate you guys coming on again, Amber Manning and Professor Taylor Black, Duke University. So thanks again for joining us, and I hope you stick with us for future episodes. So see you and talk to you soon. Later.